This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The news made headlines around the country, but had special resonance in Vermont. Senator Bernie Sanders officially threw his hat in the ring last week. He's running for president. He faces a formidable challenge in the presumptive nominee, Hillary Clinton. But Bernie says he's in it to win it. Now he just needs to sort out how. Among the details the Sanders campaign has to nail down quickly are strategy, message, and money. Here's Sanders announcing his bid for the presidency in Washington, D.C. last Thursday.
I wonder now, in this day and age, whether it is possible for any candidate who is not a billionaire or who is not beholden to the billionaire class to be able to run successful campaigns. And if that is the case, I want you all to recognize what a sad state of affairs that is for American democracy. Okay.
Sanders' first test will come in Iowa and New Hampshire, and not next winter, but starting now. Organizing on the ground makes a difference to voters in those places. Sanders has already made a trip to the Granite State since his announcement, and it's widely expected he'll be in Iowa shortly. Today on the program, we're going to take a look at what people outside of Vermont are thinking about the Sanders candidacy. We are joined by reporters with some perspective on this. Kathy Abradovich is a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. She joins us today from Iowa. Kathy, it's nice to have you on the program.
Thanks for having me, Jane.
And Josh Rogers is a political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio. He joins us from Concord. Hello again, Josh. Nice to have you.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for having me.
Well, so the fact that Bernie is running comes as a surprise to absolutely no one in Vermont. It's been the buzz for months. Was it a surprise to you at all, Kathy?
No, I don't think so. He has been spending time in Iowa. He has been the guest of some of the progressive activist groups in the state. He drew some good crowds at some of his events, and he certainly, when we would talk to him, didn't seem to be wavering about the idea of running.
And Josh, I'm assuming for you, this was not something that came as a surprise.
No, much the same as Kathy said. Senator Sanders has been here a bunch, and he's drawn some good crowds to house parties, and so it's not shocking.
So Bernie plays well in Vermont. He out-fundraises his opponents by millions. He typically sees landslide victories, but it's not clear that he's as well-known elsewhere. Here's how Jon Stewart talked about it last week on The Daily Show after Sanders officially announced his candidacy.
Let's meet whoever Bernie Sanders is. That's Colonel Sanders. Let's meet, that's Deion Sanders. That's Ned Flanders. Sure, that's Bernie Sanders. All right, fine.
All right, so Jon Stewart playing Bernie Sanders' name recognition for some laughs there. Is it really that bad, though, Kathy?
Well, everybody has to start somewhere in Iowa. And the thing about the Iowa caucuses is it's a place where somebody that nobody knows can come and introduce themselves and actually, by the end of the year, become a contender for the Iowa caucuses. So I don't think Bernie Sanders needs to worry too much about the lack of name ID. Really what he has to worry about is Hillary Clinton and her huge popularity in Iowa.
We'll talk a little bit more about that then. You know, if you don't need the name recognition in Iowa, but what Bernie has to watch out for is Hillary's popularity there. How does he make inroads?
Yeah, well, were you asking me? I'm sorry.
Yeah, absolutely.
First of all, he has to play a long game. Hillary Clinton is very popular now, but nobody knows what's going to happen down the road. Will the famous baggage that she has catch up with her? Will her campaign somehow implode? So what a guy like Bernie Sanders has to do in Iowa is you need to be everybody's second choice. You're going to build your support as much as you can, but those people who are not going to support you, who are supporting Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders needs to be their second choice. And on caucus night, because of the process in Iowa, being everybody's second choice can help you have a surprisingly better result than people maybe are expecting.
Josh Rogers, what about in New Hampshire? Is it the same deal where, obviously Hillary Clinton, well-known, she's been to New Hampshire many times. She's already got the footwork in there and the legwork done. So how does Bernie Sanders make a play in New Hampshire?
Well, he has to be here, and he has to recognize that while Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton remain very popular here with the establishment of the party, that you know, there are a lot of Democrats here who may not be wild about the Clintons. And, you know, he needs to court those people. He needs to be here. And, you know, it will be tough. I mean, Hillary Clinton already has 15 staffers working in New Hampshire. She has people running her campaign who know how to win elections here. She won here herself against President Obama in their primary here. So, you know, he has a steep climb. You know, he's in a neighboring state that's tended to help candidates here. You know, candidates going back to 72, Ed Muskie won here, Paul Tsongas in 1992, you know, John Kerry, you know, beat Howard Dean in a weird kind of next door neighbor primary. But, you know, it's I don't think anyone would say this is anything but a steep climb for him. And certainly with Hillary Clinton running as so-called, you know, on the issues of everyday people, you know, he's in a position to challenge that. And, you know, one Democrat I talked to was at a Clinton house party, not where she was appearing, but just one held by her campaign. And he was inclined to vote for Clinton. But he said, you know, no matter who gets in the race, you have to figure that they're going to immediately start with, you know, 30% of the electorate, because not everyone is going to be on board with Clinton, or at least on board early. So, you know, he's going to start with some people who are eager for somebody other than Hillary Clinton. He just has to build that out. Historically, you need to have a coalition where you have, you know, party elites who may be more liberal and also sort of more meat and potatoes Democrats who populate some of New Hampshire's small cities. And, you know, potentially, you know, he can make inroads with those people. But, you know, he's got to be here. He's got to hope that something bad happens to the Clinton campaign and just kind of grind it out.
We're hearing a little bit about what some reporters outside of Vermont are observing in Bernie Sanders' run for the presidency. Vermonters are very familiar with the two-term senator, longtime politician. But what do people in Iowa think, or even just over the border in New Hampshire? And what's it going to take for Sanders to have a good run in the primaries in these crucial states? We're taking a look at those questions today, and we'd like to hear from you. If you're outside of Vermont, how do you think his message plays in your state? And what would it take for him to sway the electorate? And Vermonters, do you have questions for our reporters about their views on Sanders? Call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. You can also post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. And let's bring another voice into the conversation here. Jonathan Topaz is a political reporter at Politico, and he joins us from Washington, D.C. Hello, Jonathan. Nice to have you.
Thanks very much for having me.
So we've been talking a little bit about how Bernie can start to make inroads in New Hampshire and Iowa. Looking at it from a national perspective and looking at his lack of name recognition in comparison perhaps to Hillary Clinton, you do say, though, that he's got a pretty consistent message, and that may help him as he moves forward. He fights in favor of strengthening Social Security. He thinks we need more wealth distribution. He's not afraid of the socialist label. He's a supporter of veterans. Do you think those messages are going to resonate with the rest of the country?
Yeah, listen, I mean, the role of a challenger is to force specificity from the front runner. And if Bernie Sanders is nothing if not specific, he's basically has been running on the exact same platform for the last 30 years. And when you talk to his strategists, they kind of joke that he hasn't changed. It's just that the country has been moving towards him and is perhaps at its, you know, really is most sympathetic to his views now than ever after, you know, years and years of wage stagnation, let's say. So these are issues that appeal to the progressive base. They're also issues that appeal to people outside the progressive base. But certainly he is looking at the progressive nooks and crannies in Iowa and New Hampshire to push these messages, which he thinks has, you know, resonance beyond those areas. But that's where he's at least starting.
All right. So let's go to Fred, who's calling in from Jay, New York. Hi, Fred. Your thoughts here.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a comment and a question. I'm actually calling, and my perspective is as an ex-Democrat who's now a member of the Green Party in New York State, and I like Bernie a lot. I think I'm just wondering what the reporters think. There's a possibility of a sort of surprise in either New Hampshire or Iowa along the lines of what Eugene McCarthy did in 1968 to Lyndon Johnson.
Fred, thanks for the call. Kathy, what do you think in Iowa?
Well, you know, everybody was surprised in 2008 when Hillary Clinton didn't win the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, the possibility of a surprise is always there. I have to say, though, she comes into Iowa stronger than she did in 2008, and the field is a lot weaker. So so the odds of something, you know, external to Hillary Clinton's own campaign, in other words, if she doesn't implode, you know, the odds that somebody else is going to overtake her in Iowa are pretty small. But I have to tell you, the Iowa caucuses are a place where the second place winner, the person who comes in second, can actually almost be crowned the actual winner, because that's a person who beats expectations, who can take a head of momentum out of Iowa merely by, you know, doing better than everyone, and by everyone I mean the national media, expects. So, you know, a guy like Bernie Sanders doesn't necessarily have to be the top vote getter in Iowa to get some benefit out of the caucuses.
You know, when we talk about how the media is treating him, certainly in Vermont, there's a lot of coverage, and we saw a little blip in coverage when he declared. But if you read some of the national coverage of Bernie Sanders, like a recent blog post in The Hill, Daniel DePetris writes, to put it bluntly, hell will freeze over before Sanders wins the Democratic nomination for president of the United States. Jonathan Topaz, do you think he's actually being taken seriously by the media?
His views are taken seriously. I'm not sure his candidacy is. You know, one point just on Iowa first, you know, Tom Harkin in 1992 won only 74% of the vote, Iowa senator. So regardless of who comes in first, there's going to be, you know, 20 to 30 to 40% of the vote up for grabs, maybe even as much as 50%. So, you know, with regards to Iowa, there's a lot of plays to be made there. But in terms of the national media, you know, listen, he's a self-described democratic socialist. He is to the left of basically anyone else in Congress. He's a guy who doesn't enjoy political theater. He's dismissed by many as a kook. He has no interest in fundraising. He won't be getting any donors. Right now, he doesn't even have a campaign manager officially. I mean, this is not a powerhouse of a presidential campaign, and they haven't really made steps to make it a really strong insurgent one. That said, he's a very dexterous politician who has views that are very appealing to a sizable wing in the party. So this is not someone whose candidacy is a joke by any stretch, but the challenges are very real, and it is incredibly difficult to see him have a path to the nomination. But does he have a path towards relevancy? Does he have a path towards pushing Hillary Clinton on issues that are very important to him and to the progressive movement? I think absolutely.
But he says, look, I am in it to win it. Don't count me out. Don't underestimate me. You do that at your peril. I mean, I realize that all candidates who declare have to say, no, I think I can win it. But, you know, is there any sense from anybody that Bernie Sanders could actually get the nomination? Josh, what do you think?
Well, I haven't talked to many Democrats who believe that's in any way possible in New Hampshire. But, you know, again, it's a long ways off. And, you know, we don't know what issues are going to emerge, and we don't know what's going to emerge from the Clinton campaign. And I guess I share Kathy's view that it's hard to see something external to the Clinton campaign and, you know, the Clinton Foundation potentially that is really going to hamper Hillary Clinton, or maybe a health issue. But it's hard to know. But I do think Jonathan's right as well that Sanders does talk articulately and persuasively to a lot of Democrats on core issues, be they entitlement reform, changes to the tax code, the fact that he's less hawkish on foreign policy than Hillary Clinton. You know, those will win him a slug of support in the New Hampshire primary, certainly. But beating Hillary Clinton in New Hampshire and running an insurgent campaign in this day and age when campaign finance rules are different, I think is going to be a real challenge. I mean, you know, despite Senator Sanders' disdain for traditional fundraising, he raised an impressive amount of money in the first, you know, day or so after getting into the campaign, about $2 million. That's, you know, a pretty good amount of money, but we'll have to see if he can actually get the infrastructure to get a real campaign going. And, you know, I do think his age is also a factor in terms of galvanizing people. I mean, the guy, he seems to be in good health, but he's going to be 74 years old in September, I think. And, you know, a lot of times insurgent campaigns are based on the idea of like sort of bringing something new. And while Bernie Sanders certainly is bringing something new in terms of a constellation campaign issues, you know, it's going to be tough for him.
We're talking today about Bernie's chances in Iowa, New Hampshire, and beyond. Give us a call if you have a thought on that from outside our borders, or tell us how you think he can win over voters in places where he doesn't have as much name recognition. You can call 1-800-639-2211 or post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. Bernie will not go along to get along, Mark says, and I don't think it's in his nature to lie, cheat, or play off technicalities just to get elected. For that reason, I think he won't be the Democratic nominee because he would speak truth to power when it's the truth that the power wants to avoid spreading. Justin says Bernie's message has been resonating well among the labor circles here in Upper Minnesota and Wisconsin. If he can gather union support in these two states, then he has a great chance at defeating Hillary in the primaries and sending one hell of a response to GOP hopefuls like Scott Walker. And Greg says, I now live in Utah but work in higher ed at an island of progressivism. Many of my coworkers view Senator Sanders as a hero. Again, tell us your thoughts. Our number, 1-800-639-2211. You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. This is Vermont Edition. And today we're trying to get outside of Vermont to take a look back in. We're gauging how Bernie Sanders looks from beyond our borders with three political reporters. Kathy Obradovich is a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Josh Rogers is a political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio. And Jonathan Topaz is a political reporter at Politico in Washington, D.C. And we're hearing from some of you as well with your thoughts on Senator Bernie Sanders. Some of you writing in, tweeting in from Vermont how you think he should make a play outside of the state, and others sharing your thoughts from beyond Vermont, how you think he's resonating, his message is resonating in your state. Keep them coming. You can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Vinny says, I think it's great that Bernie Sanders is running for president because it's important for the rest of the country to hear a different point of view. Bernie's message definitely resonates with people outside of Vermont. It did for me, and I live in Connecticut. Elizabeth wants to point out, though, that not all Vermonters like Bernie Sanders' politics. Good point, Elizabeth. That's certainly true. Let's go to Stuart, calling in from South Stratford. Hey, Stuart.
Hi. I just wanted to say I'm 67. I've been a lifelong socialist, and I'm so happy I have a socialist that I can vote for president.
Thanks for the call, Stuart. Appreciate that. Let's go to Mike, who's calling in from Ripton. Hi, Mike. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think Bernie Sanders is the first incoming president that really has the Facebook power and the social media. You know, Facebook's 10 years old. So I think, you know, we do a lot of discussion on Facebook because everybody's pretty excited about Bernie Sanders running. We've followed him for decades. And you look back at what he's saying in 1970, and it's the same thing he's saying today. And I hope that he can kind of revolutionize the way campaigns are run and it put the power back in the citizens' hands, because he said things that really resonate with the average person. The problems that we see at the bottom that the privileged at the top don't see, who seem to be the ones that win elections, he really is out there with the people.
Mike, thanks for the call. Appreciate that. I hear what you're saying. And let's put that to Jonathan Topaz. You know, as we look at this from a broad perspective, you know, Bernie, I think, is not the only candidate with a strong social media presence, and certainly all of them have social media strategies. Bernie, you've seen, though, over the years getting a lot of play on social media for some of the things he does, like the filibuster a few years ago. I mean, that went viral. So does Ken have a point here, or Mike have a point, rather, that there is a certain social media strategy that will help Bernie Sanders?
Certainly. I mean, he's very dexterous on social media, and, you know, that's something that you know, his Senate office and he has prioritized. I mean, I think you know, there's a story here that young voters are in play. You know, Bernie Sanders is 73, but young voters tend to skew more liberal, and there is some concern about Hillary Clinton's liberal chops, and I absolutely think that, you know, an important part of Bernie Sanders' coalition, if he's going to make a real run as a challenger, is going to have to be poaching a lot of young Democrats who are a little disillusioned with the Democratic establishment, and obviously social media is one way to reach out to those folks.
Kathy Obradovich, I know we have to let you go. You've got other presidential candidacy things to do today in
Iowa.
Other
long-shot presidential candidates. Yeah, Ben Carson's here.
Well, before we let you go, I want to ask you, though, you know, in terms of, we were talking about the strategy for Bernie Sanders, that he doesn't need to finish first in Iowa, but he needs to make a good showing, and he needs to gain visibility in the state. So what's the strategy in Iowa? You know, just having boots on the ground and a really strong network of organizers? Does he need to have house parties? Big rallies? What's the goal here for him?
Yeah, so there's a variety of strategies to win the Iowa caucuses. And for a candidate like Bernie Sanders, who doesn't have money, what he has is the ability to organize the grassroots. And absolutely, you know, looking for picking off young people who and others who are really unhappy with the Democratic establishment. And, you know, the advantages of the Iowa caucuses allow somebody who doesn't have a lot of money to do that. And also, you have an audience of people who are more progressive than the party in general. These are activists who are really involved and are really important to winning the caucuses. You know, people talk about Iowa, and they emphasize how important the religious conservatives are to the Republican Party. Well, the progressive wing of and progressive activists are really important on the Democratic side. So he definitely needs to organize those. The social media, obviously, is going to have to be part of it because he doesn't have money for paid media. So, you know, having a strong social media strategy is critical. And then, you know, really emphasizing the person-to-person contact. The Barack Obama campaign found out that going to people's doors was absolutely quantifiably more effective than calling them on the phone, for example. And so those are the kinds of lessons that Bernie Sanders and any candidate who wants to challenge Hillary Clinton or somebody else who has a lot more money is going to have to put in play.
That's Kathy Obradovich. She's a political columnist for the Des Moines Register. Kathy, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
We are talking today about Bernie Sanders, and we're looking a little bit at how he plays outside the state of Vermont, what the national media is thinking about, and what reporters in other states are seeing as he starts to get his campaign off the ground. Kathy was just talking about money, and you know, Josh Rogers, Sanders says he thinks he can raise at least $40 or $50 million through mostly small donations from Americans who agree with him. Some analysts think he'll be able to raise quite a bit more than that. And as you mentioned, in the first couple days after it was clear he was running, he raised, you know, $1.5 or $2 million. Now, $50 million is nowhere near what Hillary Clinton is going to spend. But is it enough to run a credible campaign?
Well, I mean, just speaking about New Hampshire, he should have the resources to run a campaign here. I just think I think, you know, if this is an election that's based on money, clearly he's not going to win. But, you know, if he can hold Clinton's feet to the fire on issues, if he has enough money to get his message out there, if he has enough money to have organizers, paid or volunteer, with the resources to put the arm on voters in a systematic way, you know, who knows? The election's a long ways away. But again, I don't think it's incorrect to diagnose his situation as a steep climb or a long shot candidacy at this point. But, you know, strange things can happen.
We got a note from Lance who says, what will happen to Bernie's chances and campaign support if or when more candidates run for the Democratic primary election? Is there a risk of him blending in with other contestants and no longer standing out? Or is his platform unique enough to carry his current momentum? Jonathan Topaz, what do you think?
That's a great question. I don't think Bernie Sanders is ever at risk of blending in. He is a unique politician, but I think it's a point well taken. Martin O'Malley looks very likely to get in late May, and so Bernie has a bit of an early start here in terms of trying to establish himself as the liberal alternative. But that's what Martin O'Malley has been doing, and O'Malley, has the former Maryland governor, has been in the early states far more than Bernie Sanders so far, although Bernie has been a good presence there. In terms of other folks who might challenge her from the left, there aren't necessarily too many. Lincoln Chafee is a former Republican, even though he's challenging her on her Iraq war vote. Jim Webb was kind of a centrist Virginia senator. So I think it's either Bernie Sanders or Martin O'Malley's to lose in terms of who can be the liberal alternative. But again, he is so unique, and I don't think he'll blend in. But in terms of getting those Iowa and New Hampshire votes, there might be some splitting votes between him and O'Malley if it comes to that.
We got a note from Laird who says, I've always loved Bernie and I vote for him every chance I get, but I've never considered him electable at the national level. I have no problem with the socialist tag. In fact, I can relate, but I've spent enough years outside the Vermont bubble to have a good sense of how that will play in the heartland. He says, I will enjoy watching him force Hillary to confront issues she'd probably rather avoid. If she can win over those of us in the hardcore Sanders crowd, that will suggest just how much movement she's made. And let's go to Nancy, who's calling in from Hardwick. Hi, Nancy, your thoughts.
Yes, thank you. I'm a Republican in Vermont, which is a Democratic state, but I'm very independent. I've watched Bernie since the get-go. He's a brave man. He's a good man. He's for the average person. We need somebody to support the middle class in America, and I think he could do it. I think he could even be president. Nobody thought he could even be mayor of Vermont. He was, and he did a good job. He put a dental clinic into our town, Hardwick, and he's helped a lot of people. So I think he's the man for the job at the moment. He's only 4 years, give him a chance. Support him, $25, send it to his home address or to the .com, and you'll see what he can do. Thank you.
Yeah, Nancy, thanks for the call. Nancy, a Republican in Hardwick, Vermont, saying she's going to vote for Bernie. And let's go to Tim, who's calling in from North Fayston. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Jane. Thank you. My question is regarding age, and I know it's already been spoken about, but I'm curious what the thoughts are of your guests regarding the Democratic Party in general. Hillary isn't that young, and are they making a mistake by not fielding someone that is a little bit younger? We've had fairly young presidents for a while now. We've got since Reagan and the older Bush, there's been Clinton and Bush himself, the second Bush, and then.
Yeah, Tim, I see where you're going here, talking about age. Bernie Sanders, we pointed out, 73 now. But Hillary Clinton is in the second half of her 60s. So Josh Rogers at NHPR, do you think the Democrats really should be putting up somebody with a little more spring in their step?
Well, I think that's a fair question, and I guess we'll see come Election Day. But it is interesting. Obviously, there's a crowd of Republicans running, and it's interesting to look at, we have Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, Scott Walker, Rand Paul, all guys who are reasonably young running, and it does bring a slightly different dynamic. I mean, you look at the core Hillary supporters, for instance, in New Hampshire, and a lot of them are people who supported her in her last run, and a lot of them are people who supported Bill Clinton when he ran here. And there is a generational aspect to this, and it's interesting in New Hampshire because for so many years the New Hampshire Democratic Party was sort of marginal in the state, wasn't terribly powerful or centralized. That's not the case now. And you look at the strength of the party and the degree to which top party officials are quite comfortable with the Clintons, are quite comfortable with people who've been around for a while. And, Senator Sanders would be old to get elected. Hillary Clinton would be old to be president. It's hard to know what to make of that. But I do think the point that Jonathan raised is interesting, that, young voters are something that are going to be, Hillary Clinton may have to work to get some of them. And perhaps Senator Sanders can appeal to those folks. But it's an open question within the Democratic Party is about, do we need fresh blood? I think that a lot of strategists would tell you that they do. A lot of them like where they are with Clinton.
We're talking about Bernie Sanders today. We're looking at how he plays outside the state of Vermont. Eric in Starksboro says, I'm a Vermonter who was recently on vacation in Florida. While renting bikes in Gainesville, we were asked by the bike shop employee, so is Bernie going to run? Everyone in Gainesville hopes he does. Eric says, so there's definitely support out there in perhaps unexpected places. And let's go to Ron, who's calling in from Rutland Town. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, hi, good afternoon. I've attended a couple of Bernie's town halls, and as some people might know, he sometimes has a meal before the town hall. And I think what he should do is he should continue that successful pattern and also go long, don't go short, don't look beyond Iowa and New Hampshire, and go to be president of all 50 states and not kowtow to the first in the nation
you know, stuff that goes on.
So Ron saying play the long game there and likes his strategy of having a meal with potential voters before, even before the town hall meeting. Got another note from Jeff who says, it's sad to me that the main talking point of the media has not been his policies, but his unelectability. Jonathan Topaz, how do you respond?
I think Bernie Sanders would applaud that. He certainly likes to jab us in the media. I mean, you know, I think Bernie Sanders has remarkable message discipline. I think it's one of the things that makes him a great politician. His ability to stay on message and talk about the policies that are he finds, you know, really important to the country. At his announcement speech, he spoke without notes, without a speech. And still went into the same statistics that I've heard him say at every single speech. So,
and also perhaps the only candidate to say, look, I don't have much time for this, right, so right. Let's just keep this moving.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, you know, there is a sense that his positions are well known. But yeah, I think he's right. I think that many of us in the media are culpable of calling the race before it's over, before it's even maybe gotten started. But, you know, there is an important issue here when you're assessing candidates and trying to, you know, tell folks, you know, who's really credible. And, you know, I think one interesting talking point that Bernie has taken from that is that even talking about those issues of electability in terms of fundraising is an indictment of the campaign finance system as it is, which is I think it's a pretty strong talking point for him.
Josh Rogers, where do you fall on that? I mean, certainly you want to talk policies and you want to let a candidate let people know where he stands. But if he's not going to get elected, does it even matter what his policies are?
Well, it certainly matters to the debate. And you know, I think there's some truth to that criticism. But, you know, elections are about, you know, who wins and who loses. And so far, for so long, the open question was, is anyone going to get in the race to challenge Hillary Clinton? Now that he has, you know, he'll be assessed on the strength of his campaign and also on how the public responds to the issues. And he's not going to get any shortage of coverage, you know, for as long as this race goes on.
Josh, it doesn't sound like he's made any big announcements about campaign staff yet or strategizers in New Hampshire or Iowa. Is that going to hurt him if he doesn't get some boots on the ground in New Hampshire?
Well, I mean, the sooner the better would be the rule of thumb. You know, we'll see. It'll be interesting to see what sort of crowds he draws. When he came here after his announcement, you know, he had a house party. He went right to an AFL-CIO event. And, you know, he did well with the union crowd. They're, you know, not a huge part of the electorate here, but an important building block of any campaign. And, you know, we'll see how hard he works it. I mean, he's going to have to work hard. You know, Hillary Clinton's got, 15 plus people and lots of supporters putting the arm on potential voters, you know, as we speak. So, you know, he'll need to work hard, but, you know, we'll see how he can move the voters here.
That's Josh Rogers, a political reporter at New Hampshire Public Radio. Josh, thanks for being with us today.
You're welcome, Jen.
Jonathan Topaz is a political reporter at Politico. Jonathan, thank you for sharing your views on how Bernie Sanders plays outside of Vermont.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll get an update on how the White River Junction VA hospital is doing with wait times and how many Vermont veterans have opted to get private medical care under new federal rules. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Last year, whistleblowers said that patients were dying because they didn't have access to medical care at the nation's Veterans Affairs hospitals, and that officials at some hospitals were falsifying reports to make it look like wait times weren't as bad as they really were. The scandal led to the resignation of Veterans Affairs Chief Eric Shinseki, and changes to the VA hospital system were later implemented. That included the ability for veterans to choose private medical care if they fit certain criteria. VPR's Charlotte Albright has been reporting on the VA hospital in White River Junction, Vermont, and we've called on her for an update a year into this story. Charlotte, remind us how Vermont was doing when this news broke a year ago.
When the news broke, the epicenter of the national scandal was in Phoenix, Arizona. So that's a long way from Vermont in so many ways. Phoenix at that point said that they were getting patients in 27 days seen, but in fact it was more like 115 days and they were falsifying those records. Here at White River Junction, we were getting patients in. 90% of them were getting in, seen in some way within 30 days, and a lot with more immediate needs were getting seen sooner than that. And an audit post-Phoenix actually verified all that. So for the whole time, White River Junction was well within those parameters.
And Charlotte, how about now? What are wait times like now?
wait times are still around that, although, you know, it's hard to measure how much better they are than that. I mean, they're just being asked to show, are you getting 90% in with 30 days? I think there is some indication that they're doing, some people are getting, you know, seen within 14 or 15 days. So in general, I have not heard, and I would be hearing by now after all these reports I've done, from veterans about wait times. That's not their complaint.
What is their complaint?
Some of them complain that White River Junction is at some distance from where they are, and that the community clinics, for example, one in Chittenden County, don't really offer them the full services that they'd get from White River Junction. And that's something that the director of the White River Junction Center, Deborah Amder, has been trying to solve. In other words, bringing the community clinics more services to them. And she's been succeeding to some extent.
Can you describe how she has been succeeding? What is being done?
Well, a couple of things have happened at White River Junction, I would say independent of the scandal, but they just happened to help the problem. For example, White River Junction opened a women's health center. Not every VA hospital has one of those. And as you know, a lot of our service people are women, so that's helping them. We also have, unlike many hospitals, a PTSD center, a national one for research. So folks with PTSD are getting better coordinated care at the White River Junction and center. And also, Deborah Amder, the director, has been beefing up her staff. She's been adding people to it as gaps show up. And because, for example, PTSD is showing up, she's added a neurologist. She's also adding primary care physicians at White River Junction. And that's not easy because, as you can imagine, there is competition for medical employees when you are situated so close to the Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center, which probably pays better. But she has been adding staff. And then post-scandal, the federal government threw $6 million our way. That's out of a total $10 billion that was a result of a recent law in August. And she's using that money to add mental health staffers in some of those community settings. So she's trying to spread it out across the state.
Charlotte, one of the other changes that was made to the VA healthcare system in the last year was the ability for veterans to get private medical care through the VA healthcare system. And my understanding is that this is for vets who live more than 40 miles away from a Veterans Affairs hospital. How many Vermonters have chosen to get this kind of private care?
Surprisingly few. It's available to about 27,000 veterans, I'm told, by White River Junction. And since August, only about 330 on the Vermont side of the river have used those so-called choice cards to access care outside the VA. In New Hampshire, there are more because the mileage rule is different there. New Hampshire doesn't have a full-service center as we do. So New Hampshire and Hawaii and Alaska got sort of an exemption. And in New Hampshire, you only have to live farther than 20 miles. So those folks are using the cards. But in Vermont, not so many.
Why do you think so few?
Well, of course, the White River Junction people would like to say it's because they're happy, right? They like the doctors they've got. And it is, think about, I mean, even you and I would prefer not to switch a doctor if we've already been seen by that person. So that's one possibility. I think the other possibility is, I don't know the last time you tried to make an appointment for general checkup, but the wait times in the private sector can be longer than the 30 days that the VA is boasting about. So, I mean, I think it really has to do with driving distance. By the way, the rule also applies if you haven't been able to get an appointment within 30 days. So it's about timing as well as driving.
Charlotte, VPR reported in December that Vermont veterans at a public forum that was sponsored by the VA hospital said they were, by and large, really happy with the care they were getting. The medical care was excellent, but some of them reported a need for better customer service at the VA hospital. Have you heard about the VA responding to that at all?
Yes, I have. Part of it has to do with the phone system. Like a lot of medical providers, the VA sometimes shops out its phone calls to call centers in other parts of the state, and those people might not be as responsive or knowledgeable about eligibility and other things that a veteran who is in need of quick care needs. So they've been trying to improve their communication more than medical care, I'd say. Who communicates with veterans? How quickly can they get a call back? Does one part of the VA center have sort of the same waiting times as another? That has been a red flag. And a lot of turnover in nursing has also been a red flag. So sometimes you don't get the same nurse each time you call. Deborah Amder, the director, admits that there's a high turnover in nursing staff, which is another problem altogether. But she has vowed to create a phone system and a communication system that is more consistent across the board.
Charlotte, what's next in your reporting on the VA system?
Well, one of the other things that I think is improved access that the VA is doing pretty well that perhaps the private sector might want to emulate is telehealth. That is, if you, let's say you've got a knee operation and you need some follow-up visits, and obviously with a knee operation, you may not be able to travel to the VA over and over again for all kinds of follow-up care, they will hook you up with a television set in your home. And they will put doctors on that set. They will take a look at your knee in that way. They will tell you how to do exercises. They will watch you do exercises. This is all pretty cutting-edge telehealth, and the VA is doing more and more of that. That's a story I'm really interested in. Medical records is another interesting story. There are people in the private medical sector who say they wish their medical record systems were as good, as robust as the VA. So it's something I think I'm going to follow over time.
That's VPR Charlotte Albright. She's been reporting on the Veterans Affairs Health System for Vermont. Charlotte, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
This month, our colleagues on VPR Classical are launching a music education series called Timeline. Each week, VPR Classical host James Stewart introduces us to events, characters, and concepts that shaped Western musical traditions. In this first installment of Timeline, James explains how the practice of writing music in the form of notes was started.
A written language is a means of writing down thoughts in a way that someone else can read and understand. We take for granted this ability to understand the thoughts of another person without even having to speak to them. Music is also a language and is also expressed through writing. Let's explore the birth of modern musical notation and the history of this elegant practice. In order to do that, though, you will have to use your imagination. Imagine yourself in the halls of St. Stephen's Cathedral, the predecessor to Notre Dame in Paris around the 9th or 10th century. You are surrounded by the music of the priests as they sing a style of song we call plainsong, or chant. You might know it as Gregorian chant, named for Pope St. Gregory the Great. These chants were monophonic, meaning just a single melodic line sung in unison. There were strict rules about which notes could be sung and which couldn't, and also rules regarding the rhythms the singers were allowed to use. This makes sense when you consider that these chants were sung in great halls reverberating off of stone walls. These plain song chants were extremely successful and spread from one cathedral and congregation to the next. It left the church and composers of these chants with an interesting problem. How do you teach someone who is miles and miles away in a different country a song that they've never heard? The answer to that question was the beginning of modern musical notation. This practice first began with symbols called neumes, little squiggles, pen strokes, if you will, over the sung text that helped the singer remember the contour or the shape of the melody. Go up here and go down there. Later, these neumes evolved into notes written on four-line staves. For the first time, a melody could be written down and read by someone else who had never heard it. Music, like language, now had a way to be written down, preserved, and shared. But unlike language, this notation offered a universal way of representing sound in time that could cross barriers and be adopted by almost every culture on the planet.
That's VPR Classical host James Stewart explaining the origins of written musical notation in the first installment of the series Timeline. You can hear the weekly program on VPR Classical and online at vpr.net. And that rounds out today's show. Tomorrow, using the stage to address thorny issues of race and racism, we'll talk with two Vermont theater companies using the tools of their trade to facilitate difficult discussions. How do you see drama and art affecting our thoughts on race issues? Write to Vermont Edition at vpr.net and listen to the program tomorrow at noon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sam Gale Rosen, with production assistance from Amanda Shepherd. Alex Keefe directed the show, and our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.